socialist wave, which she said when she won that night, that extraordinary night, was movement meets establishment. And George is right. It's not just the candidates, which is exciting, but there are movements outside the Democratic Party which are competing to take over the Democratic Party. That will be a long struggle, but we are on the cusp of extraordinary changes, and I would date it from the failure of the Democratic Party to really deal with the financial crisis of 2008, which we're on the 10th anniversary of soon.
So. And we have to leave it there. We want to thank Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, George Monbiot, the British journalist, and Sheila Menon, organizer behind the Trump baby blimp. We'll continue to cover this. In breaking news, the Justice Department has reopened a murder investigation into the death of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old African-American boy from Chicago, whose killing in the summer of 1955 galvanized the civil rights movement. The Justice Department told Congress it reopened its inquiry, quote, based upon the discovery of new information, without elaborating. Emmett Till killed August 28, 1955, while visiting family in Money, Mississippi. Till's mother held an open casket funeral for her son to show the ravages of racism and the brutality of bigotry. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. And up next is going to be the KBOO Evening News. But first, we want to take this beautiful moment to tell you that the KBOO programming you are listening to is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Radio Cab, serving the Portland metro area since 1946. With service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessibility vans, and Radio Cab mobile app. Portland Dispatch at 503-227-1212. And in Vancouver, 360-694-1234. Online at radiocab.net.
While in Atlanta, Danny Lyon joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and acted as staff photographer from 1962 to 1964. His first solo photography book, The Bike Riders, A Study of Outlaw Motorcyclists, was published in 1968. Following his publication of The Bike Riders, Lyon completed documentary work on the Texas prison system. Lyon's work is very personal and gives us, the viewer, access to people and places we wouldn't normally get to see.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Danny Lyon film screening on Wednesday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Danny Lyon will be in Portland to show the films Willie and Murderers. Again, that's the Danny Lyon film screening on Wednesday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest String Summit, July 19th through 22nd at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. The Northwest String Summit is celebrating its 17th year as a bluegrass, roots, and Americana music festival. Performers this year include three nights of the Yonder Mountain String Band and Green Sky Bluegrass. Other performers include Andy Hall, the Shook Twins, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, The Deer, Carolyn Cotter, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest String Summit from July 19th through the 22nd at Horning's Hideout, 21277 Northwest Brunswick Canyon Road in North Plains, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Earl Blumenauer has introduced a bill to abolish ICE.
And the investigation into the murder of Emmett Till reopens.
House Republicans consider an anti-LGBTQ adoption amendment to a funding bill.
Thank you.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 12th, 2018. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. According to the Willamette Week, U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer, a Democrat representing Oregon, introduced a bill to the U.S. House of Representatives today, which calls for an evaluation and eventual abolishment of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In 2002, Blumenauer was among those who voted against the creation of ICE. Blumenauer's bill, entitled Establishing a Humane Immigration Enforcement System Act, aims to create a review system for ICE functions. After reviewing ICE, the bill aims to transfer investigations into organized crimes, drugs, and human trafficking to other law enforcement agencies in order to dissolve ICE. Such a bill would require Congress to replace ICE with a new immigration enforcement system. Blumenauer states that we should be prioritizing the protection of families and our borders in a humane and thoughtful way. People should be treated with compassion and respect. ICE is simply not doing that. Trump and his administration have made the agency so toxic that it's time to abolish ICE and start over. Calls to abolish ICE have reached the mainstream across the United States since Trump's administration instituted its zero-tolerance immigration policy that has separated thousands of children from their parents and has seen asylum seekers held indefinitely in detention centers. This morning, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and Attorney General Jeff Sessions claimed that all eligible children under 5 years old, 57 in total, had been reunited with their parents, but 46 remained separated from their parents. Blumenauer's bill asserts that ICE has abandoned its mission to prevent acts of terrorism by targeting the people, money, and materials that support terrorist and criminal activities, and instead is targeting higher numbers of deportations. The bill remains a long shot to pass the House, which is controlled by Republicans, but the fact that a bill to abolish ICE has reached U.S. Congress shows the sheer force of nationwide protest against the Trump administration's immigration policy.
Multnomah County has issued a burn ban starting on Friday. High heat levels and dry weather have settled into the Portland area, and with them comes required safety precautions. KGW reports this means residents can't burn anything in recreational campfires, fire pits, yard debris, and agricultural burning, even for people who obtained a burning permit. Outdoor barbecuing is still allowed, yet fire officials said people should use caution with hot materials. Grills should be at least 10 feet from homes, fences, and plants. Portland is expected to see above 90-degree temps throughout the weekend. Stay safe and stay hydrated.
A little-known program is preserving Oregon's natural wonders, but the program is at risk if not reapproved by Congress. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, reporter C.J. Fritz has more.
Conservation groups say a little-known federal program is providing access to some of Oregon's most iconic natural landscapes. Since its inception more than 50 years ago, the Land and Water Conservation Fund has provided Oregon with more than $310 million to help keep places such as the John Day Fossil Beds, Oregon Dunes, and Pacific Crest Trail open and available to the public. The fund will lapse if Congress doesn't act by September 30th, and that's a concern for groups such as the Northwest Sports Fishing Industry Association. Liz Hamilton is head of that group.
The Land and Water Conservation Fund programs have generally maintained access for those of us who hunt and fish and hike and canoe and boat. So they're not protecting lands to lock them up. They're protecting lands for public use and public purposes.
Hamilton notes that the program already is working with half the money intended, and she would like to see it fully funded. She also says that maintaining access to public lands is integral to the state's economy. In Oregon, outdoor recreation supports about one in every 20 jobs. Kate Walney is regional manager for the travel company Oars and has been a rafting guide on the Rogue River for 26 years. The Rogue has seen more than $13 million in Land and Water Conservation Fund investments. Along with keeping open access, the program also helped preserve the home of Zane Grey, an avid fisherman and author who lived and wrote on the Rogue in the 1930s. Walney, speaking from the banks of the river, says Gray's writing inspired conserving it.
In his novels, they were fiction, but his characters had a really strong environmental message. So the cowboys would be sitting around the campfire saying things in their dialogue like, Well, you know, Kev, if we don't do something about it, these places are all going to change.
Elizabeth Burghard, the Medford District Manager for the Bureau of Land Management, says a lot of folks come to Southwest Oregon specifically to explore the Rogue River. She spoke from the historic Rogue River Ranch.
There are tens of thousands of visitors who come to this location, and I believe the last statistics that we had were that it provided for about $30 million in revenue on an annual basis, and those data were pulled from a decade ago. So it's really important to the economy.
In conjunction with Oregon News Service, and for KBOO's Evening News, I'm CJ Fritz.
KGW reported early this morning in southeast Portland, a woman's dog was attacked by a cougar. The woman stated that the dog suffered bite wounds, but is expected to survive. KGW said Portland police responded about 3 a.m. Thursday morning to a report of a cougar in the 3000 block of Southeast 118th Avenue east of Kelly Butte Park. Police continued to patrol during the morning, but there were no additional sightings. ODFW says, "Don't run, raise your arms up, and clap loud. This will make you look bigger than you are."
This month on July 26th through the 28th at the Tom McCall Waterfront Park, come see more than 70,000 beer lovers travel to the Rose City. This annual event is one of the nation's longest-running and best-loved craft beer events. Taps are open from noon to 9 p.m. Thursday through Saturday and noon to 7 p.m. Sunday. Portland Patch says the OBF will serve 80 craft beers from small, traditional, and independent craft breweries located in 10 different states, as well as the Netherlands and Baja California. The festival will present more than two dozen different beer styles, ranging from Berliner Weiss to Belgians to IPAs and IPLs, pails to pilsners, and sours to stouts. Come enjoy live music all 4 days at this vibrant festival. Lots of food booths will also be available. Alcohol is purchased with a wooden token, which costs $1 a piece. Patrons pay 4 tokens for a full mug of beer or cider, or 1 token for a taste. Portland Patch says the economic impact of the Oregon Brewers Festival on the local economy is annually more than $23 million. For more information about this festival, visit OregonBrewFest.com or follow at OregonBrewFest on social media.
A 19,000-square-foot lot will be purchased with housing bond dollars in the Cully neighborhood in northeast Portland. The Portland Housing Bureau will purchase the $500,000 property in order to place 50 units of housing on the northeast Prescott Street lot. Areas such as Southeast Powell Boulevard and Burnside Street will also be seeing construction for new housing units. Voters approved the $258 million bond, in which Portland officials are also promising to build at minimum 1,300 economical housing units in the next 5 years. As of now, there are around 300 move-in and rent-ready units accessible.
57 out of the 103 immigrant children were reunited with their parents Thursday, July 12th. The original date for release was Tuesday, July 10th, which the Trump administration postponed. Out of the 46 remainder of the children under 5, 11 may never see their parents again. Criminal records and deportation are the key factors in why these children will not be reunited. Vice News claims that officials have not defined what types of crimes make the parents unqualified to take custody of their children again. Some of the crimes, however, include DUI, smuggling, child cruelty, and murder. Some parents have also been incarcerated for reasons unrelated to illegal entrance into the country. Deportation and migrating with people who aren't the child's direct parents are also situations taken into consideration, as these children will have to stay in facilities hosted by Health and Human Services. HHS goes through the sponsorship protocol, which tries to connect the unaccompanied children with existing family members or a foster parent. A small amount of the children will get to be reunited with their families under an agreement the government set, delaying the process of reunification a bit longer. Forging of a child's birth certificate, illness, and potentially staying in the same house with an adult charged with sex abuse are all reasons for the delays. The next wave of immigrant children ages 5 and up will be released July 26th.
Benjamin McDowell, a Dylan Roof 2015 Charleston Church Massacre Copycat, was sentenced to 33 months in prison on Wednesday, July 11th. McDowell was arrested in February 2017 while he was planning an attack in Myrtle Beach at a local synagogue. In the spirit of Dylan Roof, quote, McDowell had made a threat to the synagogue's Facebook page. He was known for campaigning violence against non-whites, minorities, and Jews, and even claiming himself as a member of the Ku Klux Klan. McDowell had spent time in prison for burglary, where he befriended white supremacists and tattooed himself with white supremacist symbols. McDowell was caught purchasing a .40 caliber Glock from an undercover FBI agent in order to carry out the attack. Officially arrested in a Hampton Inn parking lot, McDowell was carrying a duffel bag with the firearm and hollow point ammunition. Previously, McDowell told the undercover agent his plan and that he would vandalize the building after the attack, quote, in the spirit of Dylan Roof, end quote. McDowell's mother, Joanne Cluess, recalls her son speaking out on the 2015 Charleston massacre, saying, quote, he just said, you know, that boy was brave, and he made headlines, you know, as a white boy, end quote. Lewis continues, quote, and he said, but he was wrong, you know, to go in the church and shoot up like he did. And he said, you know, he stood up for the white people, end quote. In addition to 33 months in prison, McDowell will go through mandatory mental health therapy, vocational training, and drug testing. After his sentence, he will be ordered to go into home confinement.
Several fast food chains have dropped non-compete anti-poaching contracts that many workers have unknowingly signed. These non-compete practices were originally intended to protect the investments businesses make with their fledgling employees. However, such contracts were found to not only harbor wage stagnation, but made it difficult for employees to have any leverage when trying to gain better pay or more hours. After the New York Times ran a story last month about these no-compete contracts, many state attorneys general picked up the case. Attorney General Bob Ferguson of Washington stated that, quote, my goal is to eliminate these provisions in all fast food contracts in my state, end quote. He has so far worked to end these no-compete contracts with Auntie Anne's, Cinnabon, and Buffalo Wild Wings within the state of Washington.
James Messer, a Knoxville, Tennessee pastor, was charged with sexual battery and aggravated statutory rape and arrested Saturday, July 7th. An unnamed 17-year-old girl was riding in a car with Messer to the Crossway Worship Center. Their original plan was to go swimming, but the conditions of the swimming area made it closed. Messer guided the 17-year-old girl through an entrance in the back of the building into a room across from the men's lavatory where he sexually assaulted her. When confronted by law enforcement, Messer told officials, quote, he thought the assault against the underage girl was consensual, according to KnoxNews.com.
Manager of an apartment complex in Indianapolis, Indiana, who is white, attempted to kick a resident out of the apartment who is black out of the pool. Shane Holland, the resident, recorded the entire altercation on camera. An off-duty law enforcement officer, also white, who was working as a security officer at the time of the incident, had confronted the resident while he was sitting down. Holland shows the officer the keys to his residency to imply he lives on the premises and that he is allowed at the pool. The officer asks for the resident's address and then is accompanied by the manager, who affirms that Holland is a resident of the complex, even using the resident's first name. The manager tells Holland, you didn't answer her question, quotes the New York Times. Why do I need to give this lady who I don't know my address, Holland replies. The manager continues to tell Holland that the pool is only for residents and being regulated. Holland's keys are then taken from his hand. Holland asks why he must provide his address to a person he doesn't know when the keys to his residency should be proof. The manager says to Holland, sign says I can ask anybody to leave at any time. The manager continues, I'm asking you to leave right now. Barrett and Stokely Incorporated, the company that owns the complex, spoke out on their Facebook page announcing that the manager in the video has been placed on administrative leave and that they will be investigating.
Republican lawmakers in the House of Representatives, sitting on the House Appropriations Committee, are attempting to add an amendment to a funding bill that would allow discrimination against LGBTQ families who wish to adopt or foster children. activists have already come out in droves to decry the bill as a license to discriminate against LGBTQ people. According to The Advocate, this year both Oklahoma and Kansas have passed state laws that allow welfare agencies to discriminate against same-sex couples who are attempting to foster or adopt kids. In total, 7 states have passed similar legislation which even allows welfare agencies funded by taxpayer money to discriminate against potential parents. Foster adoption agencies run by religious groups with anti-LGBTQ agendas promote the idea that LGBTQ people should not be allowed to adopt because they are morally dangerous to the well-being of children. If the funding bill passes with this amendment, agencies that receive any federal funding would be allowed to turn away potential parents just for being LGBTQ. The House Appropriations Committee voted to add the amendment 29-33, with only one Republican lawmaker, Scott Taylor of Virginia, voting against it. Activists are now warning that ramifications from the amendment would extend well beyond only LGBTQ parents. This bill would set a precedent allowing agencies to discriminate against interfaith couples, single parents, people who have been divorced, as well as any other circumstances that agencies could claim as a violation of the agency's religious beliefs. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi released a statement saying, quote, "House Republicans chose to sacrifice the well-being of little children to push a bigoted anti-LGBTQ agenda, potentially denying tens of thousands of vulnerable children the opportunity to find a loving and safe home," end quote. Pelosi concludes her statement asserting that, quote, "House Democrats will fight this disgusting, deeply immoral, and profoundly offensive effort with all our strength. There is no place for bigotry or discrimination in our foster and adoption systems or in any part of our democracy," end quote. According to the Human Rights Campaign, LGBTQ people represent about 2 million Americans interested in adopting a child. If this amendment were to pass, this massive pool of potential parents would go unused, leaving countless children in agencies rather than in homes.
Buffalo Grove, a suburb of Chicago, Illinois, might be hosting their own pride event by virtue of a seventh grader, Molly Pinto. Pinto was inspired by Aurora Pride, a parade that takes place in a suburb an hour away from Buffalo Grove. Not only did Aurora Pride influence the seventh grader to set up an event, but it gave her the courage to come out. Pinta came out to her friends and family, including the school's Gay Straight Alliance chapter. Pinta established the GSA at her school after attending a family member's same-sex wedding. Pinta's mother, Carolyn, who also works at the school, has shown her support for her daughter and the GSA group at school by hanging a pride flag outside of her classroom, offering flags to other teachers, and even being the sponsor for the group as well. According to Pinta's GoFundMe page, the event, which will take place in 2019, has raised $6,777 out of its $10,000 goal. The same organization who set up the Aurora Pride event, Indivisible Aurora, will also be helping Pinta financially. Pinta has also received praise from local leaders in her community, such as Beverly Sussman, one of Buffalo Grove's elected officials. She stated that, quote, "Molly Pinta wants to make a difference and have a pride parade with a purpose," end quote. Sussman continues, "Molly wants everyone to respect and accept each other. She hopes this 2019 Pride Parade will educate and bring awareness to the community. This is amazing coming from a 12-year-old girl." Pinta and her family are connecting with the local law enforcement to discuss the route of the parade.
Warning, this story contains graphic descriptions. The investigation into the murder of Emmett Till is being reopened after more than 60 years. Emmett Till was only 14 years old when he traveled from Chicago to Mississippi to visit family. His grisly murder occurred after a brief visit to a local market. The wife of the proprietor, 21-year-old Carolyn Bryant, a white woman, claimed that he had touched her. Her story then changed into one of attempted sexual assault. Her husband and her brother-in-law, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, kidnapped Till a few days later. His badly mutilated body was found in the Mississippi River a few days later. The murderers were acquitted by an all-white jury and soon after admitted to killing the young boy. Mamie Till, Emmett's mother, insisted that his body be brought back to Chicago, she held an open casket funeral, which was attended by thousands. The rage helped spark the beginning of the civil rights movement. Many decades later, Carolyn Bryant completely recanted her story to researcher and historian Timothy Tyson. This is the second time the case has been reopened.
Now it's time for Black History 365. Black History highlights the African American achievements in history for each day of the year.
Black History is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is July 12th. On this day in 1940, African-American inventor and entrepreneur Frederick McKinley Jones received a patent for his portable air cooling units for trucks carrying perishable food. During his lifetime, Jones was awarded 61 patents, 40 for refrigeration equipment, portable X-ray machines, sound equipment, and gasoline engines. He was also a recipient of the National Medal of Technology.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Climate Connections highlights ways that climate change is affecting us and what we can do about it. On today's episode, the Red Cross and how it helps victims of climate change.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When disasters strike, the Red Cross mobilizes to provide victims with food, water, and medical supplies. But the organization does more than respond to disasters after they occur. As climate change makes heat waves, droughts, floods, and extreme storms more common,
what we're trying to do is anticipate more of those conditions to actually prepare rather than just support people after they've been hit.
Martin Van Alst directs the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center. He says the center's scientists study where extreme weather is most likely to strike and how it will affect people locally. Then they use their findings to advise the Red Cross about how to help protect the people who are most vulnerable. For example, he says that in the past, flooding in Uganda has often caused cholera outbreaks. Now, the Red Cross is working to equip communities with water tanks and chlorine tablets before flooding strikes.
So that before the flood comes, people have access to those items, and they can then, after the floods, keep safe drinking water. We can prevent those disease outbreaks.
The Red Cross cannot change the weather, but by focusing on preparedness, it can help minimize the impacts of extreme weather disasters. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Currentcast is a daily piece dedicated to one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, roadside ditches.
A new job description for the ubiquitous ditch on this Currentcast.
Roadside ditches crisscross every watershed. They're everywhere.
That's Rebecca Schneider of Cornell University. She says ditches move water so quickly they cause flooding downstream and dry out the area upstream. Ditches also wash excess nutrients and sediment into streams. But changing how ditches are managed can help. Schneider says that sending the water into a wetland, lining the ditches with vegetation, and making them more shallow and wide would help to slow the water.
If we can replumb the watershed, disconnect ditches from streams, we can reduce flooding, we can reduce water pollution, and help with drought.
So with a little makeover, ditches could be providing a multitude of benefits. Currentcast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Red Fawn Fallis, the Native woman accused of firing a gun at officers in North Dakota during a demonstration against the Dakota Access Pipeline, was sentenced Wednesday to 57 months in federal prison following a January plea agreement. She faced up to 10 years for two charges and has been incarcerated since October 2016. The judge recommended she serve time in Phoenix or Tucson to be around other Native women. In a press release, the Water Protector Legal Collective states she's the second person arrested at Standing Rock to be sentenced to a substantial prison term, and the second of five federal cases the legal collective is working to close. According to the legal group, there have been more than 800 state criminal cases, and as of June, more than 150 are ongoing. A group of Native youth are credited with starting the No DAPL movement in the summer of 2016 to protect water and the environment, which led to months of activity and camps in North Dakota. The pipeline has been operating for a year. The CBC reports an Indigenous prayer camp has been set up near the U.S.-Canada border. People are opposing the Enbridge Line 3 project, which will replace more than 1,000 miles with new pipeline and facilities in both countries. Those at the Spirit of the Buffalo camp in Manitoba want to stop construction, which is reportedly underway in two provinces and expected to start soon in Manitoba. Opposition of the project includes Native groups concerned about environmental and cultural resources. Supporters and company officials say the pipeline is decades old and needs to be replaced. The camp is about 60 miles south of Winnipeg. A new report explores how Native Americans are perceived in the United States. As Eric Tigetoff reports, one of the project leaders believes it's the largest public opinion research project about Native Americans.
Crystal Echohawk says the goal of the report, Reclaiming Native Truth, is to find out about the dominant narratives and perceptions of Native people from a diverse group of Americans. It includes focus groups spanning 11 states and every race. Echohawk says toxic and contradictory stereotypes about Native Americans persist, such as ideas that they're dependent on the government, but also flush with casino money.
What we actually found was the biggest barrier that Native Americans face is invisibility and erasure. And the fact that you don't see Native peoples in the media, you don't see them on TV and film. And in fact, almost 50% of K through 12 schools in the United States don't teach about Native Americans past 1890.
Nearly three-quarters of respondents said schools need to make curriculum changes to Native American culture and history. Echohawk praises Montana's work on this front. She hopes the report also acts as a roadmap to create more positive perceptions of Native Americans. Echohawk Consulting partnered with First Nations Development Institute on the project. So many negative stereotypes have a direct effect on Native people's well-being, Echohawk says. That's especially important in Montana. Not only does the state have the country's highest suicide rate, but it is highest among Native Americans. Echohawk says suicide is one of the biggest issues Native American communities face, and it's an especially big problem among youth.
When we first started this project, we actually were challenged by a number of Native American youth who came and spoke to the leaders of the project and said, we need you to do this for us. We're counting on you. So it's really that sense of responsibility to our children that was a big driver.
Echohawk hopes the report can begin a healing process for communities.
This is really about how do we see one another first and foremost as human beings and not stereotypes and caricatures. And that applies to all different types of people in society. And I think there's a longing right now for people wanting to get out of this sort of toxicity.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Horse riders are traveling through several Navajo communities this week, making their way to the Navajo Nation capital. The horse ride is an annual tradition honoring past leaders who rode on horseback or in wagons from their homes to tribal council meetings. Along the way, they would visit with community members to take their concerns and advocate for them at council sessions. The tribal council will welcome the riders Monday in Window Rock, Arizona. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Mad Magazine's Tom Richmond. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. And then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather here in Portland and east of the Cascades will be clear skies with a high of around 64 degrees, followed by partly cloudy skies and a high of around 92 degrees, add a couple of degrees for Hood River. Today in history, Buckminster Fuller was born in 1895. After a hard time learning geometry and being expelled from Harvard twice and then losing his job, he went on to invent the geodesic dome, the Dymaxion house and car, as well as several other futurist technologies. The quote of the day is from Buckminster Fuller. There is nothing in a caterpillar that tells you it's going to be a butterfly. I want you to get on down with it. Can you feel it? You gotta ride it, baby. Yeah. It's good to me.
And now it's time for the Daily News Roundup from the Public News Service, a member-supported media outlet that aims to keep the news honest.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, July the 12th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. NATO pivots from Trump to Afghanistan. Also on the Thursday rundown, educators get guidance for supporting trans youth. And a growing number of workers don't unplug on vacation. Now our top story, NATO leaders will try today to move beyond U.S. President Donald Trump's demands for higher defense spending and focus on ending the long war in Afghanistan. That's from Reuters. They report on a trip that will also take Trump to Britain and to Helsinki to meet Russia's Vladimir Putin. The president spent the first day of the summit lambasting allies for failing to spend the targeted 2% of GNP on defense and accused Germany of being a prisoner to Russian energy. Reuters says Trump, in a late-night post on Twitter, wrote, "Billions of additional dollars are being spent by NATO countries since my visit last year at my request, but it isn't nearly enough. U.S. spends too much." On the surface, right-to-work policy sounds like something beneficial to Missouri workers, but Stephanie Carson's been talking with opponents who say it's a misnomer.
Unlike what its name may indicate, the policy does not aim to provide a general guarantee of employment to people seeking work. On August 7th, the state's voters will decide on Proposition A, which would establish the state as a right-to-work state. But worker advocates want voters to understand the impact. Lindsay Baker with the Missouri Budget Project explains.
What that does is it effectively limits the collective power of workers to negotiate for higher wages and more benefits by limiting union resources, while at the same time, it still requires those unions to extend the benefits of those negotiated contracts to those who don't contribute financially.
The Economic Policy Institute estimates that wages in right-to-work states are 3% less than those in states such as Missouri that don't have the law, even when accounting for differences in cost of living and variances in industry. Supporters of right-to-work say employees have more access to jobs with the policy.
Nationwide, there are 28 right-to-work states. Abortion advocates are holding a press conference and demonstrations in front of Florida's Supreme Court today to call on Senators Marco Rubio and Bill Nelson to reject Donald Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. The groups argue that since Trump promised to find judges to overturn Roe v. Wade, they believe Kavanaugh will be able to do just that if he gets Senate confirmation. Laura Goodhue is with the Florida Alliance of Planned Parenthood affiliates.
This is where a lot of those decisions, you know, start. We've had attacks on reproductive health care every year in the Florida legislature. Some of those have been stopped at the Supreme Court level in Florida. And we just hope that we can continue to defeat these attacks.
So far, many conservatives embraced Trump's pick, including Rubio, who said he was pleased. However, Nelson, a Democrat, said he expects to vote against Kavanaugh. The ACLU of Utah and the Utah Pride Center want teachers, school administrators, and policymakers to consider the experiences of transgender students in the classroom. Catherine Davis Young has more.
Trans or gender nonconforming young people may not always be ready to lead discussions about their identity. So Ermia Fnayan with the Utah Pride Center says it's vital that teachers and school officials do what they can to cultivate supportive situations for all students.
Trans students cannot be these warriors every day when they're simply trying to show up to gain an education.
Research from the organization GLSEN has shown a majority of trans students face bullying and hostility at school that can lead to them missing school days and falling behind academically.
And a voting scorecard by the West Virginia Sierra Club shows record levels of opposition to conservation members by state lawmakers. Dan Hyman explains.
Jim Coatson with the club's political committee has been tracking votes on a wide range of environmental legislation for more than 20 years. He says the worst score they ever had before was 3 years ago, when 11 legislators voted against every environmental proposal. Coatson says this year they have about six times as many, far worse than any previous year.
Unprecedented in that so many of the legislators scored a complete zero. We always see a few people that are voting against the environment every time, but we had 70 names on our list. That is almost half of the state legislature.
At the federal level, 4 out of 5 members of the state's congressional delegation scored a zero. The full list is at the Sierra Club West Virginia website. And finally, Eric Kalatis explains, summer is typically when workers who get paid vacation take time off to relax and recharge. But according to a new survey from Account Temps, more than half of American workers said they'll maintain some contact with work. That's up from 41% just 2 years ago.
Karen Policastro with a staffing firm says to make vacations a true escape, plan ahead, let your boss know when you'll be away, and find a few trusted coworkers who can fill in for you if the need arises.
And make sure your point person has everything they need to keep things on track while you're out.
The survey found that millennials, who tend to check their phones more frequently for social media, have the hardest time unplugging.
The U.S. is the only wealthy nation that doesn't mandate paid vacation for all workers, and according to a Center for Economic and Policy Research report, 28 million Americans don't get any paid vacations or holidays. I'm Mike Clifford. You've been newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
There's a new product on the market with the name and face of U.S. President Donald Trump on it. Asbestos building materials from Russia. Russian mining company Ural and Best put Trump's face and seal on the product that reads, "Approved by Donald Trump, 45th President of the United States," on pallets of its chrysotile asbestos products. Last month, before he resigned, Scott Pruitt had said that the EPA will not consider the health risks and impacts of asbestos already in the environment when evaluating the dangers associated with the chemical compound. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that from 1999 to 2015, asbestos killed over 45,000 people in the U.S. alone. Before last winter, 95% of asbestos used in the United States was imported from Brazil. But in November, Brazil banned the mining, use, and commercialization of asbestos, opening up the market to Russia, which has the world's largest asbestos industry.
Today, the Indian Supreme Court got together before deciding whether or not to dismiss a colonial-age law that criminalizes same-sex couples from engaging in intercourse. In 2009, India allowed same-sex individuals to engage in intercourse. 4 years later, it was criminalized again in 2013. Indu Malhotra, an Indian Supreme Court justice, said, quote, "Homosexuality is not an aberration, but a variation. Because of family's pressures and societal pressures, they are forced to marry the opposite sex, and it leads to bisexuality and other mental trauma," end quote. A petitioner's lawyer, Ashok Desai, spoke on the matter, saying that this law has created utter chaos. Desai also claims to the court that queer themes have always made their appearance in Indian culture, such as the Mahabharata, a transgender character in an Indian lore. The opposition of keeping the criminalization says that homosexuality was unnatural and against Hindu nationalism. The Indian government says they are putting their trust into the Supreme Court to make the right decision. The Indian Supreme Court will continue the hearing in support of decriminalizing same-sex relations on Tuesday, July 16th.
According to The Guardian, the Republic of Ireland is making history as the first country to sell all of its investments in fossil fuel corporations. The Irish Parliament passed the bill with support from all parties in its lower house on Thursday, and the bill is expected to pass easily in Ireland's upper house. If all goes according to plan, the divestment law will go into effect by the end of 2018. the Republic of Ireland maintains a national investment fund of $9.4 billion. The government will be required to sell all of its investments in corporations that derive 20% or more of their total revenue from fossil fuels. Such revenues could come from exploration, extraction, or refinement of fossil fuels, including coal, oil, gas, and peat. The bill holds that all such investments must be divested as soon as practicable, which is expected to mean a timeline of 5 years before all funds have been divested. Those in support of divestment assert that current available fossil fuels worldwide already exceed what humans can use before incurring catastrophic climate change. Some critics maintain that staying on as a shareholder and encouraging companies to change would be better than divesting.
If the divestment bill does pass the upper house as expected, the Republic of Ireland will have to divest over $350 million worth of investments in fossil fuels that are dispersed between 150 companies. Thomas Pringle, an independent who first introduced the bill to Irish Parliament, states that the divestment movement is highlighting the need to stop investing in the expansion of global industry, which must be brought into managed decline if catastrophic climate change is to be averted. Ireland, by divesting, is sending a clear message that the Irish public and the international community are ready to think and act beyond narrow short-term vested interest. According to Eamon Meehan, executive director of the international development charity Trocare, just last month, Ireland was ranked the second worst European country for climate change. So passing of this bill is good news, but it has to mark a significant change of pace on the issue. The divestment bill not only calls for divestment, but allows for the Irish government to make and maintain investment in Irish fossil fuel companies if the investment funds the company's transition away from fossil fuels. Jerry Liston from the Global Legal Action Network warns that other governments must follow suit because governments will not meet their obligations under the Paris Agreement on climate change if they continue to financially sustain the fossil fuel industry. Countries the world over must now urgently follow Ireland's lead and divest from fossil fuels.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is CJ Fritz, Summer Barraza, Luca Campbell, and Kyle Carezzi. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer and the KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, guest host Lisa Loving welcomes the Portland Parents Union, who's pushing back against school pushout. At 9, the Beloved Community investigates the mysterious death of Thomas Merton. At 10, Valley Views looks at the ways to reduce and possibly eliminate energy bills. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Digital Divide analyzes how to use science, medicine, and technology to improve our lives and keep them from doing harm. All of these KABU programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
KBOO reporter and producer Kyle Carrezzi had a chance to speak with Mad Magazine illustrator Tom Richmond. Here's more.
You were drawn to caricatures from doing a summer job when you were younger?
Yeah, I was going to college and I got a summer job doing caricatures at a Six Flags theme park just outside of Chicago. And that's where I just sort of discovered I had an affinity for and a real love of the art of caricature.
When you're doing caricatures of people, what features do you tend to exaggerate when you draw them?
Well, that's entirely up to the person, you know, because a caricature really is exaggerating what it is about the person that makes them unique. So the features are just the tools you use to relay that. So I'm really trying to caricature their personality or their presence, you know. So you don't key in on any one particular feature. It's just sort of all of them, how they work together and how you want to exaggerate that person's presence.
Can you give an example of someone you've drawn when you've exaggerated, like what it feels like to be with them or who they are as a person?
Yeah, like, well, you know, one of the things I do mainly for Mad is the movie and TV parodies. So when I caricature somebody, like, for example, I recently did one of the new Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, for Mad. And so I'm caricaturing Mark Hamill. But what I'm really doing is caricaturing Luke Skywalker, you know, so mm-hmm. his character is what I'm trying to bring out. So he was very, you know, gruff and, you know, very intense. And so his facial expressions, I would exaggerate his brow and how his eyes kind of crinkle together and, you know, the set of his mouth and things like that. And so I'm trying to bring out his personality as much as his features.
And have you dabbled in any other styles throughout your career at all?
Well, I mean, caricature is just one of the things I do. Almost everything I do these days is humorous or cartoon related. So might not necessarily be caricature, but like I do a lot of work for companies like Scholastic, where I'll maybe draw funny animals or just caricatures that aren't anybody in particular. But no, most of my stuff kind of falls within a certain range of cartoon, semi-realistic type look.
And can you talk a little bit about some of the favorite jobs you've had over the years?
Well, certainly the Mad work is my favorite stuff. I grew up reading Mad magazine, and it was something that I really enjoyed as a kid. And when I got to be started doing caricatures, Mad is sort of the place to do caricatures. Some of the best caricature artists ever have worked for them. And so anytime I get to do movie and TV parodies for them is a lot of fun. I do a lot of other work, like, for example, the comedian Jeff Dunham. I do a lot of work for him. I've designed a couple of his puppets, and I've done work for his T-shirts and things like that. A lot of his shirts or products and stuff have my artwork on them. So as a freelancer, you get to do a lot of really interesting jobs, and you're never just doing one thing all the time. It's what makes it so interesting.
Maybe like a month back, I was reading some Mad Magazine issues from the 1960s, and it had some really scathing satire in it. So do you think you can talk a bit about the impact that Mad had on the public and with the satire and humor?
Well, back in those days, I mean, Mad was a satire. I mean, that was the defining satire of the generation. You know, we didn't have the Daily Show or the Onion or, you know, the Colbert Show or Saturday Night Live. Mad was the place that you got that sort of work, that which made it so unique. That humor was pretty much them. And nowadays, things like the Daily Show and the Onion and stuff, they all were sort of evolved from Mad Magazine. So Mad created this whole genre of satire and snarky commentary that's so prevalent, especially these days on the internet.
Why do you think Mad has been able to sustain itself for all these decades since it was first published and still be relevant today?
Well, it's Mad is more like just a voice now among many other voices, where it used to be the voice, you know, but it still does it very well. And Mad also is one of the few places that you find the kind of cartooning and illustration that you see in its pages. I mean, you know, these days a lot of the humor and stuff that you find on the internet is very slapped together memes and very quickly put together images. And MAD still does this, you know, very elaborate cartooning and illustrative approach that you just don't find anywhere else. And I think there's a certain appeal to that. And even though MAD's a magazine, which, you know, is something that's difficult to produce these days between the costs of it and how long it takes for the magazine to get on the stands, you know, it isn't that instantaneous response to current events that you see all, you know, all the time online. Because it still has that cartooning, I think that there's a certain appeal to that that just is not going to go away.
And when I was looking at your caricatures, there's definitely an alignment with what MAD's been putting out decades before, and it fits in very well. So I'm wondering, you've mentioned it already. Can you talk more about the influence MAD had on you specifically growing up before you heard your calling?
Oh yeah, when I was a kid, you know, like third, fourth, fifth grade, MAD was our little guilty pleasure. You know, that my one of my neighbors had a subscription, and when it came in the mail, we would run over there and pore over it. You know, and it's so funny because MAD had a certain subversive quality to it, and it was almost like you were, you know, in on some adult jokes, even though you didn't really understand it. Like I remember very specifically reading the movie parody of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was a kid, I'd never see that movie and I had no idea what it was, but it was very funny to read that, and I thought I was you know, sneaking in some adult humor. And the cartooning and the artwork in there was very impressive, but at the time as a kid it was sort of over my head. And then years later when I started doing art and concentrating on it for a living, I look back at these old MADs and went, wow, I can't believe how good this art was. But as a kid it just made me laugh, and then later on I came to appreciate the craftsmanship and the talent of the artists like Jack Davis and Mort Drucker and those guys that are legends that work for the magazine.
So do you have any tips for any up-and-coming illustrators and cartoonists on getting published and getting their work out there?
Well, it's kind of harder and easier than ever to do that these days. It's harder in that there isn't as much traditional paying type avenues for your work these days. You know, magazines and publications and things like that are starting to tighten up because the internet is you know, a main source of consuming news and entertainment, and and getting paid by doing internet stuff is difficult. It just doesn't have that traditional mechanism in there. But on the flip side, it's much easier to get your work out in front of a wide audience because of the internet, you know. So you can, a lot of comic artists go straight to self-publishing their own comics on the web, you know, web comics and web graphic novels and things like that that people are doing. And there's an amazing amount of incredible work out there. The trick is figuring out how to make a living doing it that way. You have to build an audience and get them to support you, and there's lots of different mechanisms for that. But my biggest tip for anybody who wants to be an illustrator is work on your craft. You know, you can never be as good as you eventually can be. You know, if what I'm saying is never be satisfied with where you're at, always push yourself to get better and better. Because there's no ceiling for that. It's just nothing but hard work and perseverance.
Can you talk a little bit more about the Wacom workshop you're doing this weekend while you're in town?
Yeah, well, one of the things I've been doing the last year and a half or so is I've been teaching weekend workshops on how to draw caricatures. It's just something I started doing and it really caught on, and I've been traveling all around the world actually doing them. I'm doing one this weekend here in Portland. Wacom is sponsoring it for me, and it's at their Experience Center. And what I do is I sit down with this very small group, it's like 12 to 14 students, and we talk about and draw all weekend long and just dissect faces, and I'm trying to show them how I look at faces and how I try to interpret them and what I look for to exaggerate and how to capture somebody's likeness and exaggerate and create a caricature from a model. And it's a lot of fun. Get a very diverse group of artists. Some people are consummate pros that have been doing caricatures for a long time, and some people are real beginners. But it's always a lot of fun and truly a high energy, very creative time.
This is just, I guess this is a random question, But about how many times have you drawn Alfred E. Newman?
Well, if you're talking about the magazine, probably 50 times, 60 times. I don't do covers too often. I've only done a couple. So he's always on the cover, of course. But I try to sneak him into my parodies every once in a while, just in the background or whatever. But when I do like comic conventions or somebody asks me to do a sketch for them, I oftentimes draw Alfred. So I'm sure I've drawn him several thousand times by now, if you include all those.
So you did say that when you were growing up, Mad Magazine was kind of stood on a pillar of its own. But what other magazines that were kind of similar to it, if any at all? Like, did it have any peers at the time when it was coming up?
Although I had a lot of mimics, mm-hmm. I would say that. I don't know it had any peers. Probably the only one, there was two magazines that were competitors to Mad that actually, you know, had something to say on their own. One of them was Cracked Magazine. And Cracked was kind of a second-rate Mad in a way, but it had some pretty talented people working for it, so they had some gems. But National Lampoon was sort of the adult version of Mad Magazine, where there were certain lines Mad wouldn't cross in terms of adult-type themes and language and images, and National Lampoon had no such no such restraints. So they were like the adult, racier version of Mad. I didn't really see much National Lampoon, but I did see Cracked quite a bit. I also liked other humorous comics. Like, I enjoyed the Harvey comics when I was a kid. Those were the Richie Rich and Casper and those types of books, and the Disney Duck books, the Carl Barks, Donald Duck books were a lot of fun. That was some really terrific art too. So I had a very eclectic taste back when I was a kid. I loved Batman and, you know, traditional superhero comics too. So I really devoured a lot of cartooning when I was younger.
Did you do any work in superheroes at all?
Not really. I did comics for a while. I did a comic book called Married with Children for a company called Now Comics for a couple of years. That was based on that Fox TV show mm-hmm. back in the 90s.
Yeah,
and,
I love that show.
The Al Bundy.
I drew him a lot.
I did a mini series for Marvel Comics that was called The Coneheads. That was like a sequel to the 90s movie, the mid 90s movie that with Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin. And then Mad is owned by DC Comics.